All right, everyone. It is Monday, November 11th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is Veterans Day in America, and our president is speaking at the parade in New York City, and a lot of people were kind of miserable that he was there. But then again, he doesn't live there anymore anyway. Why is he there?
Well, he owns a lot of property there.
Oh, that's true. That's true. That's true. But I thought he moved to Florida.
You say he owes a lot.
Oh, wait. Hold on. Hold on. Let me. So Ron Abramson is already in studio. He is an immigration lawyer from Concord, New Hampshire. He has joined us on many occasions. It is our Rethink the Week. We'll be grabbing Val Endres from Rhode Island College shortly. Dean Spiliotis, however, is taking the day off. What is this? Was he a veteran?
Heard of that guy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I just want to remind everyone that I was in the first class of females in Air Force ROTC in 1971.
Oh, my God, Arnie.
And the reason is I believed all of us should go or none of us should go. I still believe that today at age 66.
So did you go to Vietnam, Arnie?
No. Well, actually, it was right after Vietnam. That's one of the reasons. I was 1971. So is when I when did Vietnam, the one did the war end?
73 is 70, when the helicopter people that were there.
Right. So 71, that was, but 73 was, so I was during the 1960s, and I was torn between a very conservative family, okay, I mean incredibly conservative family.
Yeah.
And growing up on Long Island with a lot of progressive liberals that I went to school with. And I was torn between listening to both of them. I would go home and have my father rant, and then I would go to school and I would hear about the war in Vietnam, and I did not know what to do. So my solution was, well, maybe if we all served, maybe we would all be engaged in the decision. The problem is the Air Force did not know what to do with us once they opened the door. They opened the door. No, it's absolutely true. They opened the door to women. Two of us joined. And within 6 months, we both looked at each other and said, you leave and I'm leaving.
Well, they weren't the first or last people not to know what to do with you.
Well, that's probably true. Anyway, so where would you like to go, Mr. Barnes, before we begin our conversation?
I would like to talk about Amy Klobuchar. I am not a supporter of Amy Klobuchar, but here is her take on running for president while female.
Okay.
Because she had some comments on that. She says that a woman with Pete Buttigieg's experience would not make it to the debate stage. And maybe there's a different standard for women. And I got to tell you, Arnie, I agree with her on that one. I don't agree with her on a lot of her policies, but I sure agree with her on that. Pete Buttigieg, a mayor of a small town, yes, he's cute. Yes, he's smart. Yes, he's articulate. But if a woman with that experience were running, they would not get any support. They certainly wouldn't get the kind of financial support that Buttigieg has gotten, which is pretty substantial. And the poll numbers are high for him as well.
He's sort of – I mean, this is going to sound awful. He sort of reminds me a little bit about the thin resume of Barack Obama. Barack Obama was a state senator. He then runs for president. He's senator for a year. For a year, okay? You don't even know where the bathrooms are in the first year. You don't even know who the staff is yet. And he runs for president. So you tell me what the difference is. And you know what it is? It's also the Democratic Party that is excited and intrigued about what is new. And female ain't new, okay? Female, unfortunately, we'll grab you in a second, Ron. But understand, this was the first, you know, black guy to really run for president. I mean, we've had other people run. But he was obviously – he had all the – he checked off all the boxes. Harvard. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean, it was like all these. And so does Pete. Pete is this gay, very attractive gay guy, checks off all the boxes, again, of people who feel comfortable in that his foot is in sort of the mainstream Democratic milieu. And at the same time, they offer newness because it is a change from what we've had in the past.
Well, I'll tell you two differences between him and Barack Obama. One is Barack Obama was elected to the United States Senate, which is a statewide office.
Wait. Who did he beat? I could have beaten him living in New York.
I don't remember who he beat in the primary, but Alan Keyes,
there was a guy that dropped out. Alan stepped in.
But
if Alan got 14 votes.
He ran against somebody in the primary. He was a substantial candidate. Happened to be corporatist and got involved with too much corporatism, just like Donald Trump, except he didn't have Teflon coating like Donald Trump
but
did. But anyway,
Barack
was elected
thin
to
resume.
A statewide position. Maybe he didn't know where the bathrooms were, but it's a statewide position.
It's
and also
Illinois.
It's a substantial state. It's a lot of people. It's a mixed ethnicity. It's a more of a microcosm of the United States than South Bend, Indiana, for crying out loud, especially for a Democrat.
I hear her.
And
I'm
speaking of women also, it may be an issue that's been around for a long time, but there are a heck of a lot of women, Arnie, as you know.
You know,
it's more than 50%
of
the population.
I know.
And they're still being discriminated against mightily. And Amy's point is right, that a woman with those credentials would not get anywhere. And also, you know, last week Joe Biden is calling Elizabeth Warren angry and antagonistic. It sounds like, you know, the same normal line of, a man who sounds like Warren will be considered strong and committed and passionate, and a woman who sounds like her is angry and bitter.
Wait, let me bring Ron in really quickly. So what has Bernie called Biden? Has he ever said any of that? What has Biden called Bernie, I guess? Maybe that's what I need to know. I know he says I'm not a socialist. That I hear all the time.
Just to loop back to the Buttigieg point, a friend of mine pointed out that last week Joyce Craig got 2,000 more votes in Manchester than Buttigieg got in his election in South Bend. Just to put it into perspective.
Oh, that's very – do that again. What's that number again?
Joyce Craig.
Remind everyone, the audience is national. Okay. So
Joyce
tell
Craig
everyone.
Is the mayor and incumbent and now reelected mayor of Manchester, New Hampshire, the largest city in New Hampshire. She received approximately 2,000 more votes in cruising to reelection than Mayor Pete did when he was elected mayor of South Bend, Indiana.
And now, the two cities are about the same size.
Wait. Let me just ask the question. This is a reelect. He also was reelected.
Correct.
My understanding, he was reelected with 80% of the vote. Are you talking about the first time he was elected?
Total number of votes. She exceeded him by 2,000 in reelection, I believe. Apples to apples. Okay.
That's very interesting.
The point being about turnout and about the actual numbers upon which he's based his political resume. Of course, he has a lot of attractive attributes.
He's
a demographic wonderkind, as he is a wonderkind on other things.
But he's gay.
He's religious. He served in the military.
Wait. There's one other thing. He ran for the DNC chairmanship. Please, you keep forgetting the politics of
that. That was before we knew how to pronounce his name.
Exactly. Mayor Pete, with a name we could not pronounce, ran for the DNC chairmanship. A lot of people noticed him then. A lot of people actually thought he could have won then. But I think to that extent, Barack Obama put his finger on the scale and made the decision who should win. But I just want everyone to know that that's where he suddenly became acquainted to not only a lot of Democrats, but a lot of Democrats who probably had access to financial resources.
But that was the second thing I was going to say is different about Barack Obama and Pete Buttigieg, and that is that Barack Obama actually did speak at the 2004 convention and was phenomenal.
Right.
So he had experience in a real serious political context, a national political context.
Amy is right.
And gave a powerful speech that really energized
Let's go grab Val.
Voters.
But let me just say something. Shirley Chisholm
Buttigieg
always
has never done that.
I know. So Shirley Chisholm always said that it was that the greatest impediment for her for any kind of political office was not her color of her skin, but the fact that she was female.
And
she
that's
said
what
that
I was
over. I capisce. I'm agreeing with you, Ken. I am, honest to God.
I do know how.
I'm just telling you. But you know, let me just say something. We're going to do a rethink the week. There's so much to talk about between what's going on with Bloomberg and Bezos and Biden and oy vey. It's also Veterans Day. Do you have a veteran? Veterans Day story, actually, curiosity?
Not a particularly compelling one.
Yeah.
I'm an immigrant. Nobody in my family has served in the United States Armed Forces, or really, as far as I know. Well, my Israeli family has served in the Israeli Armed Forces.
They're forced to.
Correct.
Right.
But
unless they're Orthodox Jews.
To me, the thing I think every year about Veterans Day is that if we truly cared about our representative democracy, Veterans Day would be Election Day. It would be a national holiday.
I think you're absolutely right.
And we would
right.
all go to the polls without fear of missing work or any other commitment.
So you know what I wanted to do after the big international festival that took place in Concord, and I was driving down the street and I saw all these flags of all over the world, and like then I went to the festival and I never felt so patriotic and I never felt so American as I did that day, standing on the steps of the State House, looking at this just display of every country in the world, and it really was about coming to America.
Come with me to a naturalization ceremony.
I've been to them, and one of the things that I suddenly realized is I wanted the flags of every country in the world out a week before Election Day, and I wanted that to be the welcoming to what would happen on that Tuesday in November. I think the idea of Veterans Day being Election Day, about putting the flags up, it is such a celebration of who we are. It's to honor those people that protected the right for us to exercise the franchise. It's to recognize that we are from all over the world, and what makes us American is not our DNA. What makes us American is our belief in a democracy and the ability to exercise the franchise. It would be so incredible. That's a really great idea. All right, so let me grab our final guest is Val Endres. Val Endres is a political communications specialist and a professor at Rhode Island College. It is our Rethink the Week. It is our Veterans Day. We were just commenting on Veterans Day, and you may have missed it, Val, but one of the things that Ron Abramson said was that he thought that Veterans Day should be Election Day and it should be a day off, and I totally agree with him.
I do, too. Yeah. Absolutely.
So how do we start that? No, I'm serious. How do we make that a national conversation? And it is such a win-win. And it really is patriotism on steroids, Ron. I mean, I seriously think that this is something that we should frankly ask every presidential candidate. No, I am dead serious. I think that's a way to make it sort of more national in scope. So appropriate. All right, so I'm going to start with you, Val Endres. So hold my hand. Talk to me about Mayor Bloomberg. What's going on here? I mean, I'm so beside myself, especially because when I saw the article that Bezos had called Bloomberg up, I think it was in May of this year, and said, you know, you should think about running for president. And I'm thinking, between the two of them, how many billions do they have? Over 200 billion at a minimum. And I think Bezos is the richest guy on the planet, and I think Bloomberg is the eighth richest guy on the planet. But the part that makes me completely and totally apoplectic is not just the fact that one billionaire calls another billionaire, but one billionaire owns the Washington Post, and the other billionaire owns Bloomberg News. This is where it's getting really, really scary. So, Val, we need to sort of put this one up and down the flagpole.
I don't know that we need to be any more frightened of that fact than we are that the billionaires basically control the means of production. And, you know, I think that probably has far more overarching influences than, for example, owning the Washington Post or Bloomberg Media Group. Although, you know, one could make the case, because you can look at Roger Ailes and Fox News and how that has influenced and polarized America in numerous ways. I think it's cause for concern. It may be that the media outlets will be ever more vigilant, but it's hard to say.
Well, but it's Ron, it's so much more than that, and that is that on my Facebook page, we've been talking a lot about Bloomberg, and so Bloomberg right now, his notoriety nationally is on issues like guns. He did the soda tax. I don't know if people remember that, but he did try the soda tax.
It was a ban, exactly.
On sweetened soda. Yeah, certain sizes of soda.
Stop and frisk.
Stop and frisk. We have to talk a little bit about that.
How else are you going to get those sodas from people?
Oh, Ron. And he's also well known on being very much of a climate activist. He has also spent a lot of money in the last election in 2018. So a lot of people, you know, they look at me and they go, but look at all the good things he's done with his money. The idea that in some ways the fact that he's a benevolent despot is such a good thing. And if we already know that there's grotesque inequality, and we already know that billionaires really get their way because they kind of, to some extent, own Washington, that because of things like Citizens United, money is speech, and they got plenty of it, so that means they got plenty of speech, why don't we just sort of cave and say, well, for a while, in order to replace Trump, why don't we just put someone like a Bloomberg in, because we at least know he has some kind of a compass. So respond to that. I'm just telling you what I'm seeing in conversation on my Facebook page.
Well, it's hard to say what has motivated the mayor to decide now. I believe he's been thinking about running for president
Elizabeth
for 20 years.
Elizabeth Warren, maybe.
Well, I think it's a combination. It's Joe Biden faltering, and it's Elizabeth Warren rising. And it is, you know, very interesting to see the reactions. What's the guy's name? Leon Goldman, who got all tearful on an interview about Elizabeth Warren's proposed taxes on billionaires. And
oh, that's right.
She has responded she has a phenomenal calculator on her website.
I have a billionaire calculator.
And
I
you
saw
can
that.
Actually choose yourself by name if you're Jeff Bezos or
Bloomberg. He would only $2 billion. That's all out of the $53 billion. That's nothing.
But,
it's pocket
but
change.
But seriously, I mean, on a substantive level, any fortune of that magnitude will always earn more just in interest than it will ever pay in taxes, even under Elizabeth Warren's plan. I don't think it's about the money. It's about the control. It's about the fact that she and Bernie and others have been truly seeking to return power and influence to the people, which has gotten lost in these last couple generations of big money and dark money and Citizens United.
So you have a difference in response. Bernie has said historically that he doesn't really think that, you know, why should billionaires even exist is the interesting question that Bernie says. Elizabeth, however, distinguishes herself. She says, no, we can have billionaires. I'm not saying we can't, but there has to be some kind of a significant contribution. And I want to remind everyone that one of the richest guys on the planet actually came from one of those democratic socialist countries. The guy that founded IKEA at one point in time was, in fact, one of the richest guys in the country. And he's from Sweden, you know? So I just want to let you know, you can still be taxed. You mm-hmm. can still invest in universal health care. You can still have a decent infrastructure system. You can still have decent public education and still get wildly wealthy. It's just kind of incredible. And I almost wish people, Val, would remind people of this. Somehow the idea of a wealth tax would suddenly mean that overnight you would no longer be a billionaire, which one of them suggested, which is just obviously ridiculous, having done the calculations
even
myself.
Even Bill Gates had that strange interview where he said, you know, to pay from $10 billion to $20 billion, okay. But when the numbers start to mean I'm kicking in $100 billion, I have to wonder, quote, what's left? And
but
I think he's got $20 billion left. But he's not...
He's not paying $100 billion.
No one's telling him that he's got to pay $100
billion. Yeah, exactly.
Offer a different idea for why Bloomberg might be running now, and it has nothing to do with anything substantive or that you might admire him for, and that is politics. There is an opening now.
Because of Biden.
Because of Biden and Elizabeth being attacked. She's at the top. But there's an opening. And when he was thinking about running 5 months ago or whatever it was tough. Why are you getting in? Yeah. It's a full field. Now it looks like we're looking for somebody desperately to be the white knight. And he's saying, hey, folks, here I am.
They're treating the Democratic primary like you treat cable. You know, we have 1,000 channels and nothing to watch. Yes. And that's how, I mean, we have really good candidates.
We do.
And there is no reason we need to add one more person who, just by virtue of their fortune, can hang in there and just change the equation, even if there's no appetite for them. Now, I have friends who are pushing back saying there's an appetite. If there's an appetite, people will respond. Well, it's not a fair comparison because Tom Steyer, he doesn't have to worry about raising money other than to get into the debates. He can stay in as long as he wants. Bloomberg can stay in as long as he wants. Any of them can decide to run third party. I think they realize the stakes are so high.
They won't.
They won't. Right. But you know, the lower tier of the Democratic field right now, I mean, there's this conversation about what Tulsi Gabbard's going to do.
Yeah.
I mean, we shouldn't have this many people. And we're looking at going in with nobody, arguably, or at least theoretically, having enough delegates when Milwaukee comes around next year.
And so the idea of a broker convention is very scary, Val. And the other thing is that we began the conversation today talking about Amy Klobuchar. And Amy Klobuchar was bitching and moaning about the fact that if she were a mayor...
Glad you said it.
Okay, I'm sorry. That if she was a mayor of a little tiny city in Indiana, there is no way in heck that she could ever be considered as a possible presidential candidate and get the kind of attention that we're now seeing.
And money.
I want to remind everyone that there are a couple of things that Amy does not include in that. One, he worked for McKinsey. Two, he went to Harvard.
Is McKinsey a pro or a con?
Yeah, really.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's...
He's taken shots at Elizabeth Warren doing corporate consulting in her field.
I know.
So need to be a little careful
but
there.
But Val, shouldn't Amy also be talking about Bloomberg in the same way now?
I think absolutely. Yeah. And, You know, one of the things that having Donald Trump as president has told us is that the mindset of a CEO is quite different.
Yes.
And even if they answer to boards, they are very used to getting their own way. And there's something, you know, I thought was so indicative of Bloomberg is that he sent somebody else to get the papers for Alabama, yeah. And he's missing the first primaries. And the one thing that we know is that campaigning and raising money, even though I'm a very strong proponent of campaign finance reform, it gets you in touch with the people.
Mm-hmm.
If you do it the Elizabeth Warren and Bernie style.
Right.
And the fact that he's skipping states, that he isn't going to town halls, it means that he really doesn't see a need, and he isn't going to be eligible for the debates by choice. And and so the American public will only hear his stylized voice in political ads.
Well, actually, that is the best comment I've heard yet. And the reason is that so he is not participating in the debates, which can only hurt him, not necessarily enhance him. But he doesn't need the debates because, one, he can buy all the ad time. He'll buy, you know what he'll do, Ron? He'll buy all the ads during the debates. I mean, he literally can he can do that. He can buy a 15-minute ad before the debate and a 15-minute ad after the debate.
But think about what you're saying.
The illusion. I mean, this
person is willing to invest how much of their money to avoid paying a tax that's not going to be a whole heck of a lot more than what they're willing to invest in a candidacy that's
probably
going nowhere.
But it's about power and control. But here's the difference. It's about power and control.
He'll have the tax every year.
It's about power and control. And I just want to end this segment by what Charles Blow wrote today in the New York Times. And here's his opinion piece. You must never vote for Bloomberg. His expansion of the notoriously racist Stop and Frisk program is a complete and non-negotiable deal breaker. And then he just gives some numbers, everyone, and I want to make sure that you hear this. In 2002, the first year Bloomberg was mayor, 97,296 stops were recorded. They surged, these are Stop and Frisk, during Bloomberg's tenure to a peak of, are you ready, everyone? 685,000. But this is the number that blew my mind. The number was this. Not only were 55% black, 32% Hispanic, and only 10% white, but Ron, this is incredible. For reference, according to the Census Bureau, there were about 300,000 black men between the ages of 13 and 34 living in the city that year. Think about this. So if you know that the number was over 600,000, that most of them were black, that means virtually every black male in the city could have been stopped once
or twice
during that year. That's like amazing. And you know why I think this is so interesting? Is what do we know about, frankly, both Bernie as well as Biden? They're doing the mea culpa about the criminal justice reform bill that was passed when Bill Clinton was president. And I'm thinking, if they had to do the mea culpa.
Super predators.
If they had to do that, then imagine how does Bloomberg deal with this issue? I mean,
That's the problem. I mean, putting aside the chutzpah, to put yourself into the mix like that, he's substantively not someone that the Democratic Party of 2019-2020 would seem to want.
Right.
But the centrists, the moderates, the status quo preservers are trying to sell us on the need to put in someone safe because we don't want to take the risk of losing to this president if he's able to stand for re-election.
Right.
And it's infuriating to think about the multiplicity of double and triple and quadruple standards we have, because this is the most extreme administration we've possibly ever seen, yet we're talking about whether a Democrat's too extreme in order to beat Donald Trump.
That's a brilliant point. And Val, really quickly, but that I looked in the swing states, and the swing states numbers, two-thirds of the voters that voted for Trump in 2016 in the swing states are still prepared to do that. And I mean people that had voted for Barack Obama and then voted for Donald Trump. So for whatever reason, they still see something that Trump is attractive about, that they're willing to do that. So those swing states are not as reliable as we think. The other thing that I do think we need to remember is there is also a deflated vote in that swing state. So it isn't just those that went from Barack Obama to Donald Trump. Now the question is, how do you then find the new voters to come in and sort of change the dynamic in those states for 2020? But those numbers coming out of the swing states are really depressing.
Yeah, they are, but I would caution that these are early times and early polls, and probably what we should be looking at is polling on people's positions on issues. And if you're talking about a way for the Democrats to get a handle on this, is to be able to talk about those issues in ways that people can understand. Because I don't think those people in the swing states are that far apart from some of the Democratic candidates. It's just that they haven't been paid attention to, and they still haven't. There were in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Right. Yep.
And we can't make that mistake again. We have to understand what motivates them. And like you said, we have to bring in the young people to vote, and they're raring to go. But we need a candidate that can galvanize them, and we've got to be able to get across our message as clearly as possible.
So when we come back to Rethink the Week, we have to talk about it. This has almost been an impeachment-free zone for a while, but it does go public this week, and it raises so many questions, including the fact that the Republicans want to bring Hunter Biden into the mix to testify. So there's a lot to talk about. This is The Attitude with Arnie Artison and producer Ken Barnes. A little labor history is next, and then we continue our Rethink the Week.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1887. That was the day that four men were hung in Chicago for their alleged role in the bombing at a labor rally at the city's Haymarket Square a year earlier. Eight men were put on trial. Although the prosecution did not prove any of the men had ties to the bombing, five were sentenced to die. Louis Ling died in jail before the execution could take place. The others were martyred for their support of the labor movement and the fight for the eight-hour day. Three of those executed were born in Germany. August Spies and Adolf Fischer worked for a Chicago German-language workers' newspaper. George Engel owned a toy store. Backlash against foreign-born anarchists helped stoke public hysteria over Haymarket. The final martyr was Southern-born Albert Parsons, the editor of The Alarm, an English-language workers' paper. The day after they died, the Chicago Tribune reported on the brutality of their execution, writing, quote, "Then begins a scene of horror that freezes the blood. The loosely adjusted nooses remain behind the left ear and do not slip to the back of the neck. Not a single neck is broken. And the horrors of a death by strangulation begin." Thousands of mourners joined the funeral procession of the five slain men. In 1893, Governor John Peter Altgeld granted the three defendants still in jail a full pardon. The monument to the Haymarket Eight stands at Forest Home Cemetery, just west of Chicago, drawing visitors from across the world to remember these martyrs for the eight-hour movement. May Day is celebrated as the workers' holiday around the world in commemoration of the events in Chicago. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Wilson Woody Powell served in the Air Force during the Korean War. But in the decades since, he's become staunchly anti-war. Through the group Veterans for Peace, Powell has spoken out against conflicts, sought justice for civilian victims, and mentored veterans with PTSD. Now he's turned his attention to yet another cost of war, the climate.
War plays a big role in climate change. All the wars that have fought over fossil fuels, for instance. Wars that have fought on smaller levels over hardwood forests in South and Central America. The carbon footprint of the U.S. military itself, which is very, very large.
Powell recently drafted a resolution that urges all Veterans for Peace chapters to take climate action and help educate students and others about the issue.
I was brought up during World War II. I was 9 years old when it started. And I saw the mobilization that went on. where we completely switched over our manufacturing facilities from making refrigerators and automobiles to making tanks and planes and so forth.
He says it will take a similar level of commitment to defeat global warming, and he hopes veterans across the country can help win this fight. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound, a buck. Or a pound, a buck, or a pound is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round.
Money, 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 money.
If you happen to be rich and you feel like...
Oh, I love this song. I just want to play it. I'm so sorry I have to end now. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I even know this song. This is from Cabaret, am I right?
It is. Willkommen.
Oh, I love... God, yeah, do I love
that's
it.
That's Alan Cumming, who amazingly has a good voice.
Amazingly has a good voice.
Well, you've seen him act in these very dramatic roles.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, I tell you, that talent is amazing. Speaking of amazing talent, in studio we have amazing talent. We have Ron Abramson.
Shucks.
You should see him. He looks like he belongs in Cabaret. Anyway, Ron Abramson is an immigration attorney. He joins us on a regular basis. He's from Concord, New Hampshire, and he's incredibly smart. Joining us right now, also incredibly smart, is a political communications specialist and a professor at Rhode Island College, Val Endres. And while we are talking money, we do have to talk about a couple of things. We have to talk about the impeachment trial goes public this week, or the impeachment process goes public this week. We have to talk about Giuliani and Ukraine. And just, Val, during the break, you did not hear this. I need to pass the torch to Ron real quickly, because we heard some interesting comments today by Nikki Haley. And in a lot of ways, it sort of steps on a lot of the conversation we're going to be having about impeachment and going public, because she was responding to some thoughts that she was approached by a number of people within the administration to join them because they were really worried that Donald Trump was a threat to the nation. And that included, you know,
Tillerson,
people.
Kelly.
Exactly. The chief of staff. And I mean, it's just incredible. Secretary of State. So, Ron, refresh our recollection of about 2.5 hours ago, because I think that's when this story broke and we decided that we should have rethink the hour as opposed to rethink the week, because so much is – and that is to benefit Donald Trump. I mean, the more confusion, the more flood of information, the more changing scenario means that we can never focus on one thing because there's always something else happening 16 seconds later. And it involves Donald Trump, but it takes us in a different direction. So refresh our audience's recollection. What happened this morning with Nikki Haley, and what are people suggesting she is attempting to do by this sort of interesting public declaration of, but I wouldn't join them?
Well, in a what's now become a common playbook, she has authored a book. It's been released, or it's about to be released. It's called With All Due Respect, which is an interesting title. And I don't know if it's out or if excerpts have been released, but basically she says what you said, that she was approached to effectively help be a counterbalance to some of Donald Trump's worst impulses and actions, and that she demurred. And that was that. But based on when she stepped down from the UN, some people thought she was going to distance herself from this administration.
Right.
This book shows that far from it, she's basically coming to the president's defense. And there is a theory, I have nothing to back it up, but I've seen it online.
But I love the theory. Keep going.
That says that she is positioning herself as the alternative in the event that Mike Pence is kicked to the curb as the vice presidential nominee for the next election.
Wow.
Or that she wants the mantle of the base in 2024 as well.
Yeah, that may be another thing. But I think what Nikki did, though, was so – she's really good at threading the needle. Because in a lot of ways, What she does is, I mean, she doesn't truly trash the chief of staff either or the secretary of state, even as she's saying this, because apparently what they had said to her was it wasn't that they wanted to remove Donald Trump, but they just didn't want to share certain information with Donald Trump. And they kind of wanted to sort of keep him from it since they knew he wasn't curious anyway, and that they would sort of make the decisions. And it really wasn't going to engage or involve him because he really was a threat to the nation. And I think what Nikki is lucky about is she wasn't involved with those day-to-day things. She was at the UN. Nothing she did was really as problematic as what the chief of staff and the secretary of state is. So she could sort of push them aside, and it really didn't impact what she did. So to a large extent, Val, she's kind of a genius because she didn't have to make these decisions. Nobody approached her. She did her own thing at the UN. They didn't even know what she was doing at the UN. She would say opposite things of Donald Trump at the UN, but she did it in such a way, and she had such a finesse about it that he never either felt threatened by her, and then she managed to leave at the exact right time. So again, the woman is magical at moving the pieces around the chessboard without actually making commitment to any play.
How much of that is genius, and how much of that is luck that she happened to be in New York at the UN and not in D.C.?
No.
All genius involves some luck.
Yes. All genius does involve some luck. You're absolutely right, Ron. It's just fascinating.
So luck doesn't always involve genius.
Well, Correct. That's true. Well, we didn't say it went the other way. Anyway, so Val, let me bring you in real quick. So this week, we go to the public events with the impeachment, and obviously it's going to be very orchestrated, and the strongest witnesses are going to come first. So what does this mean for the American people? Will they repeat it in prime time so everyone can make a decision? Do I watch, you know, Grey's Anatomy, or do I watch this? Do I watch WWF? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out whether it really matters where they play it, because I'm just trying to figure out how much more of an audience you'll actually get.
Well, research shows that during the Nixon impeachment trials and also with Clinton, that the impeachment, people watching the impeachment actually made a difference, and to both presidents' detriment. And Democrats held on to their support of Clinton, but there were Republicans who were initially somewhat supportive of Clinton that turned against him when they heard the trial. And same thing happened with Nixon that we saw in much larger numbers turning against. I think this is going to be different because we didn't have the internet there. Yeah. We didn't have Twitter. We didn't have our ideologically friendly groups. And so I think we're going to watch differently. So totally. When I was watching the Nixon trial, I was working in a nursing home. I just graduated from high school. And I was standing there watching in the workplace with people that had a variety of perspectives on the issue. Mm-hmm. Now I'm much more likely to watch it on MSNBC, mm-hmm. Where I'll have commentators mm-hmm. that support my view, mm-hmm. or with Twitter people that I have chosen to follow. And so I think what will happen is that the polarized groups will become and stay or even become even more polarized or stay as polarized as they were before. So I don't necessarily think that the public viewing is going to change opinion.
Ron, do you agree with Val on that? I mean, I totally agree with Val on this one. And I think part of the reason is you can't look back at Nixon and Clinton and really glean anything useful. Every time I hear them do it on MSNBC or CNN, I want to like give the TV a knuckle sandwich because I keep thinking this is so incredibly different, in part because Trump has changed the political conversation, the political landscape to such a dramatic extent that to look back is to look at a time when we actually had presidents. And now what we have is someone who is just the master manipulator, and he actually thrives in the negative. He thrives in lying. And all the things that would be shocking, it's his asset, not his liability. So what's to be shocked about when we hear this coming forward during the trial or the public hearings?
I'm not going to contradict the learned professor, and that's a little depressing to consider, but I do draw some small measure of hope from knowing how long it took for public sentiment to build and then turn against President Nixon. And you know, that the podcast Slow Burn, right, that Slate did was excellent. Mm-hmm. And all the reading I've done, and I've consoled myself with reading about Nixon's impeachment over the last couple of years. You know, it's my bedtime story.
Oh, good.
Should read it to my 4-year-old.
That's what cheers you up.
And then he resigned. Good night. No, so it is discouraging, but it's also there are some cracks. If you look at polling, that matters. And it's going to take a couple of key Republicans to stick their neck out. The question is, who will it be?
Yeah.
You have Justin Amash, who very publicly left the party, but the House isn't the issue. And then you have people like Rand Paul, who you might have thought could have possibly done the right thing, but he seems to be, less and less a libertarian and more a Trumpist as time goes by.
And Mitt Romney, who's a presidential candidate himself.
Well, I mean,
his rhetoric has been good.
You're much more optimistic than I am.
Well, and
I'm younger.
You're younger. Well, let me just say something, Val. So as we have the younger Ron talking to us, I keep thinking that the other thing is that perhaps what we need to do, because I think it will not be seen or heard by people who watch Fox or listen to Rush. I think, and if it does, it'll be through the filter. I mean, we had Barr filter the Mueller report.
But they will listen to Trump's victimage. That's where the problem is, and that's what Nancy Pelosi has feared all along, is that base isn't moving. And I'm not optimistic that we're going to see Republicans who are going to turn on Trump. You know, they had plenty of opportunity to do in the past. They still have to answer to the base.
So here's what I'm trying to think about, is that I think there's going to be some really powerful testimony where people will really be appalled. Not the people that we want to be appalled, but people will just be reinforcing their appallness, whatever the term is. What I'm trying to figure out is there a way to market this? And what do I mean by that? I mean, is there a way to pull out some just incredible testimony, run it as ads, put it on social media, run it on Fox, run it on Rush, and just say, okay, no comment. Just say it and just say, this is who said it. That's it. So I want it so that everybody knows those words, not just Donald Trump's words. I mean, we know everything Donald Trump says because he has T-shirts that say it. He has hats that say it. He says it on Fox and then Rush repeats it. There's an incredible echo chamber for his lies. There is no echo chamber for the truth. And I'm just trying to figure out, Val, is there a way for us to create that echo chamber? And it's not elected officials, but the ambassador, but the people there using their words and saying, these are people who have served this country for 40 years. This is what they saw, and they feared for our safety.
Yeah, I think you're assuming that there's a logical cause and effect relationship, and I'm not sure that there is. So, for example, Trump's defense right now is read the transcripts. Right. And if you read the transcripts, you understand that they're very problematic. But yet he continues to say it as if he is the victim and that somehow it will exonerate him. And he's counting on the fact that his base won't read the transcripts, that they will listen to him.
Well, could I just comment on that, Arnie? I agree that his base won't change their mind because they're listening to the echo chamber, just like the progressive strong base is not going to change our minds. But the question is really, let's try not to generalize, and whose minds do we care about changing? And if it's independent voters or people in swing states or even energizing our base, I think that televising those hearings and having some factual basis for people who have open minds, it's possible that they're not going to be victims of the echo chamber.
Well, so let me just say something, Ron. So what I know is that we're looking really at suburban women. Okay, that is our marketable swing group. Everyone thinks we have to swing, people in North Carolina and Alabama. No. I mean, we're not going after Trump's base, and we don't even care what they think because they don't care to think. I mean, that's the problem. If we cared what they thought, then we would think that they actually are processing, but they're not processing.
Well, we could still address gerrymandering and voter suppression efforts so that we have more accurate results in the South. But I agree with you on what you're saying. We're not going to get the people at the MAGA rallies to say, it turns out he wasn't the honest person we expected.
But changing the suburban women's perspective on this is not going to equal the Senate voting for convicting Trump.
I'm not sure anything will get the Senate to vote to convict Trump. What you want, though, are a number of Republican senators to do it. I'm not sure you're going to get to goal, but the most important thing is how many Republican senators can you get to actually support removal? And that is, that's ultimately the, and so everyone,
you don't think
well, that's
and the other
wrong?
Interesting X factor, who presides over the impeachment trial in the Senate? The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, but here's what we're learning about this. This is so depressing
to
me.
Which way does that cut?
No.
What we know is actually the senators are both the judge and the jury because they control almost the entire behavior of the Chief Justice. When you begin to realize the rules that they can set, the rules that they can change, the time that they can set, I mean, they literally, he is almost becoming part of a puppet for them. And so everyone keeps talking about them as actually acting as jurors, but nowhere on the planet would jurors have the kind of control over the judge that the United States senators have. And I think, Val, this is really important because people think that this is going to be a trial and that these people are jurors. What they need to know is that their behavior and how they change the rules because they can do it with a simple majority is frightening for what we'll end up actually seeing from that Chief Justice. So in a lot of ways, he may walk in with a robe, but he doesn't do very much that people with robes do. And I think people need to know that. They just don't. And that, I think, is unfortunate. All right, so we haven't talked about this, but one of the things that we've seen with both the Bloomberg and with Donald Trump and with the billionaires and with, you know, who's running on the Democratic side is Elizabeth Warren. And Elizabeth Warren and Bernie, with their progressive message, has really been about grotesque inequality, taking on the billionaires, making change to some of the things that dramatically need to be changed. But it turns out that Medicare for All is really top of the charts. And everyone is so terrified by this. They're also terrified, Ron, by the kind of math that Elizabeth Warren is presenting. Not that she doesn't have an answer and she says she doesn't tax the middle class, but at some point in time, when do we address the real rationalization that you have to pay for something? And whether you pay, I mean, middle class people pay for health care. They pay for health care as a portion of their premium. They pay as a copay. They pay as a deductible. They pay now. And by lying, and I really think this lying, by saying to them that they will not pay for Medicare for All denies the fact that they are actually paying a tax now, but it's called a private insurance tax.
But she's not saying they're not going to pay. She's saying she will not fund this by raising taxes on the middle class. And her her formula bears that out. Now, what I say, and I will in full disclosure say I'm a strong supporter of Elizabeth Warren and her candidacy. What I say to people is I don't understand why – maybe it's every campaign, we hold people accountable as if they're going to, with a stroke of a pen on day one, get their proposals passed. Elizabeth Warren is expressing an important value, and she's showing a roadmap that makes it feasible. Does that mean it's going to happen? Does that mean we're going to have Medicare for All within her first term? Probably not. But she has identified this tremendous problem, this tremendous strain, not just on our economic resources, but on all of our mental health, all of our consciousness is so tied up in the stress of not knowing. And as one person tweeted that I read, you know, Americans are okay with a 20% payroll deduction for private insurance, like you're saying, Arnie, but God forbid we pay 5% so that everybody's covered.
I know. It is so shocking to me, Val. And the problem is that, once again, who's pushing the narrative for the fear of Medicare for All? But it's really the insurance industry. It's big pharma. It's a couple of big hospitals. I mean, we have to realize who is making – who's playing the fear card. But you know what I think is the most problematic? I want to have a come-to-Jesus moment with the UAW. I want to have a come-to-Jesus moment with the firefighters. I want to have a come-to-Jesus moment with a lot of the unions because they unfortunately are sucked into the idea that somehow because they have negotiated their private insurance that Elizabeth Warren is a threat to them. And you know what? What I'm trying to figure out is do you talk to the leadership of the UAW or do you talk to the membership? Do you talk to the leadership of the firefighters or do you talk to the membership? membership, because I think the leadership is massaging themselves. I don't think they're actually benefiting their rank and file. But I want to figure out, how do you tell the rank and file that by not supporting a Medicare for all, you're actually reducing the kind of paychecks
yes.
they're going to get? They're going to reduce the kind of stability for the future. And frankly, as someone who has talked to a lot of public sector workers, you're going to reduce the support that public sector workers get because they have great insurance, but most of us in the private sector do not. So the sense of resentment for what happens for the public sector is, oh, look at you. You get a decent paycheck. You get a decent pension. You get a decent health care, and I don't. So screw you, because my taxes
right.
are paying for your health care.
And the irony.
What happens is that the people that are in the unions are actually paying for the uninsured. They just don't know
exactly.
that they are by higher bills in the emergency room, for example. But I would say that Elizabeth Warren also has an obligation here to talk about some of the consequences of what is inevitably going to happen if you stay on your insurance. And she also needs to talk about it as part of your salary, which she hasn't enough of. And I think what becomes also more important is to a point that you made earlier. If you're talking about Medicare for all, we aren't talking about signing a bill on day one.
Of course
so
not.
So she needs to talk
a bit about
those interim steps.
Right, exactly. And I think the interim steps are really important. Bill Curry, by the way, who is a political analyst from Connecticut and was actually a Clinton advisor, is fabulous on this issue. And he's a big Warren supporter. He supports single payer, but he really does see about the sort of rational steps. Like one of the things he mentions, Ron, for example, is that immediately what you could do within the first year is bring every public sector worker into the Medicare for All. So all the federal employees, all the state employees. So therefore, it's not even touching the private sector. It is just bringing in those people that are already on the government payroll. And right there, you change the dynamic overnight just by doing that.
But and the irony of that, or the just maybe the beauty of it
is taxes are already paying for that.
Well, exactly.
That's right.
Firemen and police,
right.
firefighters and police are an example of what this is.
Exactly.
Most of us will not need these services, we
right.
hope.
Right.
But we're all, unless you're a hardcore libertarian, willing to pay for it
right.
because we understand the value as a whole to keeping society stable, to keeping society
right.
safe.
Right, right.
And this is the same thing. It's just that the actual service is on an individual level. Now, there's a legitimate concern, which is if government, quote unquote, takes over healthcare, will the delivery of healthcare be as good as it is now? And that's a legitimate conversation to have.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not, we're not even getting to that.
So let me just say something about the delivery. If you go to Texas, if you go to northern New Hampshire, talk about all the hospitals that have closed. So during the private sector version of healthcare, now there are like, I think, 40 small hospitals have closed in like New Hampshire. I won't even tell you how many have closed in Texas. And small hospitals are like the essence. And you think about this, and I keep thinking about what's happening with healthcare, but I'm thinking about closing Planned Parenthood, closing small hospitals. What you see and the vulnerability of populations is just exploding for people. And here's my dream, Val. And I begged a reporter from CNN to do this. And she was working on the 2020 sort of election for CNN. And I said, will you bring in all the union heads and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie and maybe somebody else on Medicare for All and have a town hall conversation with the unions and them? Okay, in front of everyone so we can all hear it, which would be really interesting because in a funny way, a lot of those swing state folks, they look to their UAW heads going, oh, you don't like this. You don't like this. And I want that conversation to be held in a public setting where we can all hear it. And then all those kinds of questions get asked. They have never done it. They said, oh, what a good idea, Arnie. Well, it's a good idea that guess we know who doesn't like it. The insurance companies and the pharmaceuticals who pay
sure.
for the ads.
Sure.
And Eva, real quick.
Well, I was also saying that people in unions don't get the best care that they deserve as well, because many of them don't engage in preventive care because of their deductibles
yes.
that the union has
yes.
negotiated
exactly.
for them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. All right, thank you, Val Endres, professor at Rhode Island College. Thank you, Ron Abramson, phenomenal immigration lawyer from Concord. And how do we end our show, monsieur?
Well, with the Beatles singing, Baby, You're a Rich Man.
Ah, totally
politics
appropriate.
Is all about
being
money.
Rich. Here
Rest in peace, Trump baby blimp.
Beautiful people. How often have